Chapter 31. The Fokker F-7B lay where she had crashed, undisturbed for over 70 years. The inverted plane had collected blowing sand by the truckload until her right wing and most of her fuselage was completely buried. Some distance behind, the port wing and engine lay hidden, crushed against the same rocks that had torn it off during the forced landing. The nose of the plane was mashed in like an accordion, the cockpit filled to the brim with sand. Buried in the dust, the crushed skeletons of the pilot and co-pilot were still strapped in their seats. Pitt brushed away a thick layer of sand from beneath the pilot's window until he could read the faded name of the plane, Blessed Betty.
"Heck of a place to set down," Giordino said. "I thought you said these old birds were indestructible."
"Nearly. The Fokker trimotors, like the Ford trimotors, were a rugged aircraft. Admiral Byrd used one to fly over the Arctic and Antarctic. Charles Kingford Smith flew his Fokker F-7, the Southern Cross, across the Pacific Ocean back in 1928. Powered by the Wright whirlwind motors, they could practically fly forever." Pitt was well-versed about the old airplane. His own Ford trimotor was wedged in with his collection of antique cars back in Washington.
"Must have been done in by a sandstorm," Giordino speculated.
As Noyon watched from a respectful distance, Pitt and Giordino followed the sand-scrubbed belly of the fuselage aft until they found a slight lip on the side. Brushing away a few inches of sand, they could see it was the lower edge of the fuselage side door. Both men attacked the soft sand, scooping away a large hole in front of the door. After several minutes of digging, they cleared away an opening around the door with room to pull the door open. As Giordino scooped away a last pile, Pitt noticed a seam of bullet holes stitched across the fuselage near the door. "Correction to the cause of crash," he said, running a hand across the holes. "They were shot down."
"I wonder why," Giordino mused.
He started to reach for the door handle when Noyon suddenly let out a slight wail.
"The elders say there are dead men inside. The lamas tell us that we must not disturb them. That is why the nomads have not entered the aircraft."
"We will respect the dead," Pitt assured him. "I shall see that they are given a proper burial so that their spirits may rest." Giordino twisted the handle and gently tugged open the door. A jumbled mass of splintered wood, sand, and broken pieces of porcelain tumbled out of the dark interior, settling into a small pile. Pitt picked up a broken plate from the Yuan Dynasty, which was glazed with a sapphire blue peacock.
"Not your everyday dinnerware," he said, recognizing it as an antiquity. "At least 500 years old, I'd wager."
Though admittedly no expert, Pitt had acquired a working knowledge of pottery and porcelain from his many years of diving on shipwrecks. Oftentimes, the only clues to identifying a shipwreck's age and derivation were the broken shards of pottery found amid its ballast pile.
"Then we have the world's oldest as well as largest jigsaw puzzle," Giordino said, stepping back from the doorway to let Pitt peer in.
The interior of the plane was a mess. Mangled and splintered crates lay scattered over every square inch of the main cabin, their shattered porcelain contents strewn across the floor in a carpet of blue and white shards. Only a few crates wedged near the tail had survived the violent crash landing intact. Pitt crawled into the fuselage and waited a moment for his eyes to adjust to the dark interior. The dim cabin and stale, dusty air inside lent an eerie feeling to the Fokker's interior, which was augmented by the rows of wicker seats hanging empty from the ceiling of the inverted aircraft. Ducking his head slightly, Pitt turned and moved first toward the intact crates near the tail section. The broken bits of porcelain crunched under every footstep, compelling him to move tentatively through the debris. he found 5 crates that were still intact, with Fragile and Attention British Museum stenciled along the sides. The lid on 1 crate had been jarred loose, and Pitt grabbed the loose section of wood and pried it open. Inside was a large porcelain bowl wrapped in a loose cloth. Over 700 years old, the bowl had a serrated edge and was glazed greenish-blue over the white clay base. Pitt admired the floral artistry of the design, then placed the bowl back in the crate. As the debris on the floor seemed to confirm, the plane was carrying a packed cargo of antique ceramics and, thankfully, no passengers. Pitt moved back up the inverted aisleway where Giordino joined him at the side door.
"Any clue to the cargo?" he asked in a hushed tone.
"Just that it was headed to the British Museum. A few boxes survived in back. Appears to be all antique porcelain." Pitt moved forward, creeping past the first row of seats and toward the cockpit bulkhead. Much of the cargo had been thrown forward when the plane crashed, creating a mountain of debris in the front of the cabin. Pitt stepped over a large fractured pot and spotted a dusty leather jacket lying amid some debris on the floor. Stepping around broken shards, he hoisted a broken crate out of the way to take a closer look, then froze in his tracks. Under the dim light seeping in from the doorway, he could see that the jacket was still occupied by its original owner. The mummified remains of Lee Hunt lay where he'd expired, decades after he pulled himself out of the crash in agonizing pain from a broken back. His left arm tightly clutched the yellow wooden box, while his bony white right hand was wrapped around a small notebook. A wrinkled grimace was etched into Hunt's face, his features well preserved by the dry desert air and a thin layer of silica.
"Poor devil. He must have survived the crash only to die later," Pitt surmised in a hushed tone.
"That box and notebook evidently meant something to him," Giordino replied. With an uneasy reverence, Pitt carefully removed the box and notebook from the skeletal grip, handing the wooden box to Giordino. Noticing a dirty, worn fedora lying on the floor nearby, he gently placed it over the face of the corpse.
"I don't presume the pilots fared any better," he said, looking forward.
Carefully stepping over Hunt's body, he moved to the forward bulkhead and tried to peer through the cutout into the cockpit. The entire compartment was filled with sand, which had blasted through the pilot's windows when the plane crashed.
"It would take the better part of a day to excavate that," Giordino said, looking over Pitt's shoulder.
"Maybe on our next visit," Pitt replied. He had little doubt that the bones of the pilots would be found preserved beneath the heavy layer of sand. The 2 men made their way back down the fuselage and climbed out the side door into the bright sunshine. Noyan was pacing back and forth nervously, but stopped and smiled with relief when Pitt and Giordino exited the craft. Giordino held the yellow wooden box up for Noyan to see, then gingerly pried off the lid. Inside were the bronze tube and the tightly rolled cheetah skin, in the same pristine condition as when discovered by Hunt.
"Not exactly the crown jewels," he said, eyeing the contents with minor disappointment.
Holding the bronze tube up toward the sun, he saw that there was nothing inside.
"This ought to tell us something," Pitt said, holding open the notebook.
He flipped open the cover and read the title page aloud. "Excavations at Shang Tu, commencing May 15th, 1937. Field Diary of Dr. Lee Hunt, Expedition Leader."
"Read on," Giordino said. "I'm dying to know if the cheetah skin was destined as a footstool in Dr. Hunt's library or as a pillow for his mistress's boudoir."
"My friends, we must be on our way if we are to catch the bus to the monastery," Noyan interrupted.
"The mystery will have to wait," Pitt said. He slipped the diary into his shirt pocket, then walked over and closed the Fokker's side door. "How about our friends inside?" Giordino asked. "I'll call Dr. Sargov when we make it back to Ulaanbaatar. He should know who to contact in the Mongolian government to ensure a proper excavation is carried out. We owe it to Dr. Hunt to see that a professional retrieval is made of the artifacts he gave his life for, as well as see that he and the pilots are given a proper burial." Pitt scooped a pile of sand in front of the airplane door to keep it sealed, while Giordino stuffed the wooden box into a leather saddlebag. Then they remounted the horses that Noyan had held, settling into the uncomfortable wooden saddles.
"You sure there weren't any down pillows inside those rear crates?" Giordino asked with a wince.
Pitt just shook his head with a smile. As they trotted toward the village, he turned and gazed a last time at the dusty remains of the old plane and wondered what secrets Hunt's diary would reveal. An hour's ride took them to the diminutive settlement of Senj. The village, such that it was, would be found on few maps, as it was nothing more than a few gurs crowded around a small watering hole. The spring flowed year-round, offering permanent sustenance for the resident herders and their flocks, who otherwise would be forced to migrate several times a year in chase of fertile grasslands. As was the usual case in the rural countryside, the camels and horses milling about the village greatly outnumbered the human residents. Noyan led Pitt and Giordino to a gur flying an orange banner, where they tied the horses to a staked rope. Several small children were busy playing chase with one another nearby, stopping for a moment to ogle the strange men before resuming their game. Climbing off his horse, Giordino swayed like a drunken sailor, his legs and rear aching from the hard saddle.
"Next time, I think I'll try the camel and take my chances with the humps."
Pitt was equally sore and glad to be standing on his feet.
"A season with the herd and you'll be riding like an arat," Noyan said, referring to the local horseman.
"A season in that saddle and I'd be ready for traction," Giordino grumbled.
An elderly resident of the village spotted the man and hobbled over on a game leg, speaking rapidly to the boy.
"This is Otgonbayar," said Noyan. "He invites you to visit his gur and enjoy a bowl of irag."
The low whine of a truck echoed off the surrounding hills, then a small, faded green bus crested a ridge and turned toward the village, trailing a cloud of dust. Noyan looked toward the approaching vehicle, then shook his head.
"I'm afraid our bus has arrived," he said.
"Please tell Otgonbayar that we appreciate his invitation, but we'll have to join him another time," Pitt said.
He walked over to the old man and shook his hand. The old man nodded and smiled in understanding, exposing a pair of toothless gums. With a loud squeal of its brakes, the bus ground to a stop and the driver tapped the horn. The playing children ceased their roughhousing and marched single file to the bus, hopping inside after its accordion side door swung open.
"Come on," Noyan said, leading Pitt and Giordino aboard.
The 1980s-era Russian-built bus, a KAVZ model 3976, was a forgotten relic of the Soviet Army. Like many vehicles that ended up in Mongolia, it had been passed along from the old guardian state long after its useful life had been reached. With faded paint, cracked windows and bald tires, it showed nearly every one of the 250,000 miles that had been placed on her. Yet, like an old boxer who refuses to quit, the beaten hulk was patched up and sent back onto the road for another round. Climbing up the steps after Noyan, Pitt was surprised to find the bus driver was an older Angla man. He smiled at Pitt through a white beard, his ice-blue eyes sparkling with mirth.
"Hi, boys," he said to Pitt and Giordino. "Noyan tells me that you're from the States."
"Me too."
"Grab a seat and we'll be on our way."
The bus held 20 passengers and was nearly full after scooping up kids from 3 neighboring encampments. Pitt noticed the seat behind the driver was occupied by a black and tan dachshund, stretched out on its side in a deep sleep. The seat opposite the aisle was empty, so he plopped down there, Giordino sliding in beside him. The driver closed the door and quickly wheeled out of the village. Driving clear of the working herd, he mashed the accelerator down as he shifted through the gears. With a shrill whine from its engine, the old bus soon crept up to 50 miles per hour as it bounced over the hard desert surface. "Bolongine Monastery ain't exactly a destination resort," the driver said, looking at Pitt and Giordino in the rectangular mirror mounted above his visor. "You boys on one of those horseback adventure tours of the Gobi?"
"You could say that," Pitt replied,
"though I hope we're done with the horseback portion of the tour. We're just looking to return to Ulaanbaatar at this point."
"Not a problem. A supply truck from UB will be at the monastery tomorrow. If you don't mind spending the night with a cadre of high-rolling monks, then you can hitch a ride on the truck in the morning."
"That would be fine with us," Pitt said as the bus lurched over a rut. He watched in amusement as the dachshund flew into the air, then landed back on the seat without raising an eyelid.
"If you don't mind me asking, what are you doing out here in these parts?" Giordino asked.
"Oh, I'm helping a private archaeological foundation from the States that is helping rebuild the Buddhist monasteries. Prior to the communist takeover of Mongolia in 1921, there were over 700 monasteries in the country. Nearly all of them were ransacked and burned in the 1930s during a devastating purge by the government. Thousands of monks disappeared in the annihilation, either executed on the spot or shipped off to Siberian work camps to die in captivity. Those not murdered were forced to renounce their religion, though many continued to worship in secrecy.
Must be difficult for them to start anew with their church relics and holy scripts long since destroyed.
A surprising number of ancient texts and monastery artifacts were buried by alert monks in advance of the purge. Important relics are turning up every day as some of the old monasteries reopen. The locals are finally becoming comfortable that the government abuses of the past are not going to recur."
"How did you get from laying bricks to driving a school bus?" Giordino asked.
"You have to wear a lot of hats out in the boondocks," the driver laughed. "The group I'm helping with isn't simply a bunch of archaeologists, but also includes carpenters, educators, and historians. Part of our agreement with rebuilding the monasteries is that we also establish schoolrooms for the local children. The structured education available to children of the nomadic herders is pretty spotty, as you can imagine. We're teaching reading, writing, math, and languages in hopes of giving these rural kids a chance at a better life. Your friend Noyon, for example, speaks 3 languages and is a whiz at math. If we can offer him accessible schooling for the rest of his childhood and keep a PlayStation from falling into his hands, he'll probably grow up to be a fine engineer or doctor. That's what we are hoping to offer all of these kids." The bus crested a blunt ridge, exposing a narrow valley on the other side. At its midpoint, a splash of thick grass dotted with purple shrubs added a sparkle of color to the otherwise monotonous desert. Pitt noticed a cluster of small stone buildings built in the thicket, sided by a handful of white gurs. A small herd of camels and goats were corralled nearby, while several small SUVs were positioned at the southern end. "Bolongine Monastery," the driver announced. "Home to 12 monks, 1 lama, 17 camels, and an occasional hungry volunteer or two from the U.S. of A." He threaded his way down some coarse tire tracks, then pulled the bus to a stop in front of one of the gurs. "School's in," the driver said to Pitt and Giordino as the kids clambered off the bus. Noyon burst by, waving at the two men before hopping off the bus. "Afraid I need to go teach a geography lesson," the driver said after all the children had departed. "If you boys head to the large building with a dragon on its eave, you'll find Lama Santanai. He speaks English and will be glad to look after you for the night."
"Will we be seeing you later?"
"Probably not. After I take the kids home, I promised an overnight stopover at one of the villages to give a talk on Western democracy. Was nice chatting with you, though. Enjoy your visit."
"Many thanks for the lift and for the information," Pitt replied.
The driver scooped up the sleeping dachshund and grabbed a book of world geography from under his seat, then waltzed toward the waiting classroom inside the Gur.
"Nice fella," Giordino said as he stood up and then stepped off the bus.
Pitt followed, noticing a placard above the driver's visor that read, "Welcome. Your driver's name is Clive Cussler."
"Yes," Pitt agreed with a searching nod. "But he drives like Mario Andretti."
They made their way across the compound toward three pagoda-shaped buildings whose upturned roofs were layered in an aged blue ceramic tile. The central and largest of the three buildings was the main temple, flanked by a shrine hall and a storeroom. Pitt and Giordino walked up a short flight of steps leading into the main temple, admiring a pair of curvaceous stone dragons that were mounted on the corner eaves, their long tails curving up the steeply angled roof. The two men mindfully entered the temple through an immense open door where a chorus of low chants greeted them. As their eyes adjusted to the dim illumination provided only by candlelight, they saw two broad benches that ran lengthwise across the temple, ending near a small altar. A half dozen elderly monks sat on each bench, facing one another across the center aisle. The monks sat cross-legged, dressed in bright saffron robes, their shaved heads held perfectly still as they chanted. Pitt and Giordino tiptoed clockwise around the temple, taking a seat along the back wall and watching the remainder of the mantra. Tibetan Lamaism is the practiced form of Buddhism in Mongolia, the religious ties between the two countries forged centuries ago. Prior to the government purge, nearly a third of Mongolian males were practicing lamas, living an ascetic existence in one of the many unadorned monasteries scattered around the country. Buddhism nearly vanished during the communist reign, and a whole generation of Mongolians is just now being reacquainted with the spirituality of their ancestors. Pitt and Giordino could not help but feel the mystique inside the temple as they observed the ceremony, which differed little than that practiced by lamas hundreds of years before. The scent of burning incense enchanted their noses with an exotic aroma. The interior of the ancient temple exuded a warm glow from the candlelight, which flickered off the red-painted ceiling and the bright crimson banners that hung from the walls. Tarnished statues of Buddha in various incarnates dabbled the nooks and altar. Then there was the haunting sound from the lips of the noble lamas. The craggy-faced monks repeated in unison a line from their prayer books, which lay open in front of them. The mantra slowly grew louder and louder, the voices rising in intensity, until an elderly lama with thick glasses suddenly rapped at a goatskin drum. The other monks joined in the crescendo by ringing tiny brass bells or blowing into large white conch shells until the walls of the temple shook. Then, as if an invisible hand suddenly turned down the volume, the crescendo slowly fell away to complete silence, the monks meditating in quiet for a moment before rising from their benches. The lama with the thick glasses set down his drum and approached Pitt and Giordino. He was nearly 85, yet moved with the strength and grace of a much younger man. His deep brown eyes shined with warmth and intelligence.
"The Americans who wander the desert," he said in heavily accented English. "I am Santanai. Welcome to our temple. We have included a prayer for your safe travels in our worship today.
Please excuse our intrusion, Pitt said, startled at the Lama's knowledge of their arrival.
The path to enlightenment is open to all.
The Lama smiled.
Come, let me show you our home.
The old Lama proceeded to guide Pitt and Giordino around the temple, then led them outside for a walk around the grounds.
The original monastery dates to the 1820s, he explained. The occupants were more fortunate than most during the Great Purge. Government agents destroyed the living quarters and the food stores, then drove away the faithful. For reasons unknown, the temple was left untouched, abandoned to stand empty for many decades. The sacred texts and other articles of worship were secured by a local herdsman and buried in the sands nearby. When the ways of tolerance were resumed by the government, we reopened the temple as the centerpiece of our monastery.
The buildings look hardly the worse for wear after all those years, Giordino noted.
Local herdsmen and underground monks secretly maintained the temple during the years of repression.
The remote location helped keep the site out of the prying eyes of the most troublesome government atheists. But we have much work yet to do to restore the compound, he said, motioning toward a stack of lumber and building materials.
We live in the Gers now, but we'll someday have a permanent residence structure.
You and a dozen disciples?
Yes. There are 12 monks here, plus a visiting aspirant.
But we hope to provide housing for an additional 10 young men before long. The Lama led Pitt and Giordino to one of the smaller buildings beside the main temple.
I can offer you accommodations in our storeroom. The Western archaeological team visiting us is working at a nearby site for several weeks. They have left behind several cots that you may use. You wish to catch a ride on the supply truck tomorrow?
Yes, Pitt replied. We are anxious to return to Ulaanbaatar.
It shall be arranged. I must return to the temple for a tutoring session. Please make yourself comfortable, then join us for our evening meal at sunset.
The Lama quietly turned and strode to the temple, his loose red robe flapping in the breeze. Pitt and Giordino climbed a short flight of steps and entered the storeroom, which was a narrow, windowless structure with a high ceiling. They had to step around a giant iron bell just inside the doorway, a weathered relic in need of a bell tower. Past the bell, they found flour, noodles, tea, and other foodstuffs stacked along one wall. On the opposite side were bins of blankets and furs, stored for the frigid winter months ahead. In the back, they found several canvas cots beneath a painted image of Sakyamuni, the Buddha sitting cross-legged on a lotus flower throne.
Odd that he knew we were in the neighborhood, Pitt said.
It's a small desert, Giordino replied. Look on the bright side. We don't have to sleep on the ground, and we have plenty of time to relax until our ride shows up. As a matter of fact, I think I'd like to test out our new accommodations straight away, he said, stretching out on one of the cots.
I've got some reading to do first, Pitt replied, making his way toward the door before the snoring began.
Taking a seat on the front steps of the storeroom, he gazed in thought at the ancient temple and the dust-strewn valley stretching beyond. Then he pulled open the rucksack and began reading the diary of Dr. Lee Hunt.